This is Terry Lynn Carrington, and you're listening to KZSC 88.1 FM.
My name is John Malkin, and the name of this program is Transformation Highway. Today you'll hear an interview with jazz drummer, band leader, and educator Terry Lynn Carrington. Carrington has recorded and toured with many cutting-edge musicians, including Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, and Esperanza Spalding. Carrington is founder and artistic director of the Institute for Jazz and Gender Justice at the Berklee College of Music, and her two Mosaic Project albums brought together women instrumentalists and vocalists, including Chaka Khan and Natalie Cole. She's also the first woman to win a Grammy Award in the Best Jazz Instrumental Album category in 2013 for Money Jungle, Provocative in Blue. Terry Lynn Carrington performs tonight with her band Social Science for one show at 6:30 p.m. at Kumbwa Jazz Center in downtown Santa Cruz. The band's 2019 album, Waiting Game, is eclectic and powerful, bringing together jazz, hip-hop, rock, opera, and avant-garde musical styles to shine a light on the long history of social justice struggles in this country and the ongoing movements for intersectional justice. Here now is Terry Lynn Carrington. This is KZSC 88.1 FM, KZSC.org. Hey, I love your drumming, and I love the Waiting Game and this new, you know, maybe not that new, but new band, Social Science. And
thank you.
Yeah, just amazing, eclectic sound that you brought together. I love interesting music and beautiful music, and I have also done a lot of political activism. So I love political music, and it's pretty amazing that you've brought this together, being explicitly political. So maybe, you know, start off telling me a little about that. I was thinking about jazz and it having a tradition of being political, being social, but it also being pretty well known for not being explicitly political. Yeah. You know, I was thinking about Nina Simone, Mississippi Goddamn, and Fela Kuti, you know, explicitly political. And some of these songs, most of these songs on The Waiting Game are really beautifully explicitly political. Tell me about bringing those elements together.
Well, I think you're right about jazz having a history of being involved with social justice work, but missing, you know, in some ways, just missing one important element in social justice work, which would be gender equity. So we're at a time now where everybody seems to be pointing out that, you know, these things are connected, racial justice, gender justice, as well as all the other justice struggles. And I think people are seeing the, you know, the intersection between all of these justice struggles now, which is great. Because, you know, a lot of Black women, for instance, felt in some ways like they had to choose, you know, about what they were going to be passionate about, you know, or what they were going to fight for, whether it be, you know, racial justice or gender justice. So it was interesting, you know, that, you know, and most came to the conclusion that I'm a Black woman, how can I, you know, how can I prioritize one over the other? So yeah, that creates, you know, a unique intersection for me personally. And then tying in the fact that, you know, you have to be cognizant of really all the justice struggles, because they are all connected. And, I always tell my students, you know, how would it be? You're in an institute for jazz and gender justice. And how would that be if you go outside and litter, for instance, or, you know, you don't treat the planet properly, or you don't consider ableism and all of these other things.
Yeah, it's important to consider all these pieces.
No, absolutely. And then to come to a place where you can shape music, you know, around those ideas or put the ideas together is, I think, you know, it took me a while to do it. And, you know, it took a while for my consciousness, I think, you know, to really get there as well. But the important thing, I think, is to make sure the music sounds good. You know, and I think there's a lot of people that have been ambitious with doing social justice projects. I mean, we're seeing quite a few right now. And I appreciate that, but I'm not into it unless the music sounds good too. So it's a tricky one, because sometimes, you know, it can get too heavy or too, you know, like too much like you're preaching or you know, didactic or, you know, whatever. These other, all these things can happen when you try to merge, you know, that kind of consciousness with music. So, and you're under a lot more scrutiny, I think, too, because you're starting to tell more of a collective story, not just your own personal story.
Mm-hmm. I think there's sometimes, too, this idea, maybe especially in pop music, and rock and roll, if you are mentioning too specifically people and places and issues, it dates your music and you don't want to do that. I kind of understand that, but then I also really appreciate the specific explicit political stuff. I used to host this radio show for 20 years on Free Radio Santa Cruz, which was the longest running pirate station in the country. And we played Mumia Abu-Jamal all the time. And, you know, I heard his voice on your song here, and, you know, you're singing about him and bringing in him and the Black Panthers and Leonard Peltier, you know, all these other people, Assata Shakur. And it's really important to have, it's great to even just mention them, and then we're hearing their voices too. So it's really powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always liked to kind of work, you know, work with speeches and, you know, people's voices and use it as a way that instrumental music can convey certain kinds of thoughts without vocals, and, you know, somewhat frustrated sometimes with instrumental music because that element, you know, is not there. And it doesn't need to be there all the time, of course, but I think, you know, I've grown accustomed to really loving messages in music and vocal music and the emotion that, you know, the kind of magic that can happen when, you know, words and music come together. So, you know, always trying to think of creative ways to do that, you know, rather than just have, you know, the vocal song. So yeah, but getting Mumia to record that for the album was really big highlight for me, because I was gonna just use a sample and I had to get clearances. And when I talked to his attorney, she said he didn't want me to, I had to end, you know, pay $200 to the prison to use his voice, and he didn't want that. So he re-recorded it. So then I was able to have him add, you know, social science part and all of that.
Oh, that's interesting, actually. It sounds like then he recorded it himself somehow and bypassed the prison, and you didn't have to pay the prison?
Yeah, he just did it on the telephone with his lawyer.
Yeah, interesting. That's how I always heard him doing these short segments. It's on the phone, and you can hear, just like on your album, you hear the prison recording. You know, this phone call is being recorded. That's so beautiful that it's his voice saying, you're listening to Terry Lynn Carrington.
Yeah, exactly. Because when he was going to redo it, I thought, well, could you announce the song, you know, as if this was a radio station?
Hey, would you just tell me a couple of things about what's happening now and what you're a part of with this album and these songs that are some of them focusing on, we need to change the way community safety happens in this country. And that's something that I've been focused on for 30 years. And a lot of people have. For some people, it's kind of brand new. And the last 2 years, somehow, while we're in this pandemic, and then George Floyd and a bunch of more young Black and brown people get killed as usual, somehow it made this explosion happen around the world. And we've never heard so many people around the world saying, stop killing us, and we need to change the way policing happens. I'm just curious why, if you have ideas about why that's happening now, and
I don't know. If I had ideas about that, I'd probably be, doing something else for a living, writing, being a philosopher, I don't know. But I'm happy that it's happening, one, and two, I think that's generally what happens, like the heat of a moment, the heat of things come to a head at some point. I mean, if you look, history has always kind of proven that, eventually, progress is on the side of history, or we would still, be slaves. I mean, so, and, other things too, before that and after that. So I think that it was just time, it's been time, time's up, that's really what happened. Mm-hmm. Time's up. And it just, some of the things that go on, you can't believe that this is 2020 and, some of this is still happening. You would have thought that we would have been able to address this long before now, in a modern society, that, it's just, wrong to kill people without, cause. But I'm just grateful that I'm alive to see this shift taking place, because it definitely feels like a shift. And that's kind of, with the collective consciousness or, think around this issue. But I'm also, seeing shifts in these other areas too, because our students are really ahead of the game in this generation. It seems like it's saying, stop, enough is enough, but from gun laws to Black Lives Matter and everything else. So I'm learning from my students, and I'm grateful that this generation has figured things out, and grateful for the tools that they have and the way they use them, for the way they use technology and all of those things. And there's upsides and downsides to everything. So I don't want to be that older person that puts it down all the time, and romanticizes, which I do, about how things were. Yeah, I do that on one hand, but the other hand is balancing that out by saying, no, I embrace all the new technologies and what young people have to say, because I know that history has also proven that they are the leaders of most justice movements,
Hey, I want to ask you, more about the music that you're making. But before that, let me just ask a couple more things about the words and the people you're mentioning. One of them is Angela Davis, who's a powerful mm-hmm. voice and has been for a long time, and continues this fight towards abolition of prisons and policing. And she teaches here, at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
Well, not anymore. She's retired. Yeah, she's a emeritus title of some sort. But yeah, she's one of my best friends.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. I just vacationed with her this month, August.
Oh, really? Really? Fantastic. I did an interview with Gina Dent, who you probably know too.
Of course.
You know, not too long ago. Yeah, great. The thing I keep thinking about with Angela and Gina is being conscious of what becomes a non-reform reform. You know, everyone's trying to make changes, and there's a tendency that some of the changes make things worse. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that. And also, you know, back to you're mentioning, you know, how we might expect that things would have changed already more than they have. And I have that feeling often too. And I'm also really optimistic. So I do also share that view that we are just naturally moving towards more healthy connections. That's just the way it has to be on this planet. And I think of Nina Simone, you know, who was singing, they keep telling us to go slow. That's the problem, go slow. And your album is called The Waiting Game. And I think a lot of people are tired of being told to slow down and to wait. I don't know if you have any thoughts about these things, you know, how we can end up making things worse when we're trying to make them better. And this thing of, we're kind of done waiting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that things get, you know, I think you have to be radical. And I think things are messy when they're changing, and we can't be afraid of that. I mean, there's different schools of thought, you know, and I think it takes all approaches. It has to be, you know, it has to be kind of holistic and from, you know, these different areas. I mean, some people are gonna get more done in certain settings if they tailor their activism to that setting. So I understand that, like, you know, though a lot of people didn't agree with Martin Luther King and nonviolence, I don't know, you know, he might have saved a whole lot of lives, you know what I mean? And he may not have been as successful. So I feel like, you know, we're at a time where I think we have to embrace change, you know, quickly. And not that being radical means it will happen quickly, but what I'm really trying to say is, like, we have to embrace the uncomfortable nature of it all, and when things get messy. Yeah, and that's for everybody. You know, I can say something like that and think about how, you know, I've been in situations where I'm uncomfortable talking about race in a room full of white people, but now I'm not. And that's, you know, really liberating, because if you look, you know, back at why you're uncomfortable, there's only a couple of reasons. And one would be that you take on an extra burden of not wanting to make them uncomfortable. So that's one reason. And another reason is you're kind of like happy with the status quo of things, and you feel like, yeah, this may not be 100%, you know, what I'm looking for. This may not be 100% optimal, but it's okay. So let me just ride this wave. And yeah, I think for a better future and a more equitable and fair future for everybody, those things can't really be, you know, if you're kind of really contributing to this change and these things we're talking about, I think those two things I just mentioned really can't be on the table. Definitely not my job to make anybody else feel uncomfortable. And if I'm the type of person, which I generally am, is I'm uncomfortable if other people are uncomfortable, because I don't want people to be uncomfortable, right? But now I have to embrace that and say it's not my problem. You know, if they're uncomfortable, they have to figure out how to not be uncomfortable. Or just because I, you know, function, you know, well, you know, whatever, in this boardroom or with, you know, the president of this organization or a college or whatever, doesn't mean that I can't, that I don't need to, with all of my actions, really be advocating for other people that may not have the same opportunities that I do.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, coming to those areas is important in this moment that we're experiencing now, and what's happened over the last year and a half or so has brought all those conversations to the surface, and you know, those feelings and thoughts to the surface, and now we're able to work them out, you know. And that doesn't mean, you know, I'm just saying, like, you know, I'm not saying like it's a black white thing. I'm saying just people in general are able to work them out, because there's a lot of, even if you start talking about gender equity or gender justice, there's a lot of women that are very comfortable with patriarchy. So that are somehow benefiting or invested in it somehow. So a lot of, you know, some of the work I do has to deal with that too. You know, it's not just trying to pull all the men in jazz, you know, forward. Some of them are already there, even if they're not fully educated or versed in it. But there's just as many, you know, percentage-wise, you know, of course, there's a lot more men in jazz, but there's, you know, many women that are not progressive thinkers in that way, so.
Mm-hmm. How has that been for you, you know, maybe especially when you started playing drums and jazz, and how men and women treated you? I think that you started playing pretty young, and your father and grandfather were drummers.
Yeah, my grandfather played drums, but he passed away before I was born. And my father, he played mostly saxophone, but he played some drums too. Hmm. So his father's drums were in the house. But yeah, but how? What are you asking me? How was what?
I guess two things. What was your attraction to the drums? It sounds like they were sitting there and available, yeah, which makes it, you know, more possible. And then how were the adults around you, the men and women? Were I can imagine some people at that time said, drums aren't for girls.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The good thing is I was young enough that I wasn't paying attention to all that, so I didn't really take it in. The people that thought it, I just didn't pay attention to, you know. And I think that that kind of, when you're young, that kind of like, you know, I mean, they say ignorance is bliss. I don't say it's ignorance, but it's more children aren't thinking, you know, about that. So I just thought I could do whatever, because I had parents that were supportive and nobody told me that I couldn't. So, you know, not in my own house and family. So why would I pay attention, you know, to somebody else if they said that or they had negative energy toward it? So I think that's an advantage, because you haven't formed all your thoughts. You're not as affected, you know, as a kid, you're not as affected by society. It hasn't really hit you yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know. I mean, I knew it was different. I didn't see any other women or young girls playing drums. I didn't see any, but that didn't deter me, because as a kid, I wasn't seeing gender too much anyway. I wasn't identifying that women should do this and men do this. You know?
You're listening to an interview with jazz drummer, band leader, and educator Terry Lynn Carrington. My name is John Malkin, and this program is called Transformation Highway. This is KZSC 88.1 FM, KZSC.org. Here again is Terry Lynn Carrington. The Waiting Game album is really incredible for a lot of reasons. One of them, you know, you've got these two CDs, the one that is like 42 minutes straight, improvised, amazing flow and story. And then the other album that has, you know, jazz and hip hop and, you know, rock guitar and operatic vocals, you know, that just open up and glide, and the lyrics that are political. It actually, in a funny way, it reminded me of this album by a Navajo punk rock band that I've interviewed. They're called Blackfire. 20 years ago, the Ramones, Joey Ramone helped them produce albums. And so they put out CDs that have traditional Navajo ceremony music, their dad chanting. And then they have, you know, the other CD in the two CD set is punk rock. So you've combined jazz and all these other musical styles. Tell me about the joy of bringing together all these styles.
Yeah, well, I think I always tried to do that, but I wasn't embraced. It wasn't embraced by labels, you know, at the time. In fact, like my second album got shelved. And I was just really happy when people started, you know, creating independent music and becoming independent artists without labels really telling them what to do artistically. So as labels started to fold, or more and more independent music was being made and supported and breaking through and all of that, it created an opening, you know, for people to not have to be so genre, what's the word? There's an expression somebody said to me recently. Well, basically not to be in like a genre prison. I felt like I could, you know, just do more of what I had been sort of trying to do, but I also got better at doing it, or mixing the genres and having, you know, some artistic freedom, which when I started in 1989, it wasn't really so possible to do. But on this last album, I also collaborated with people and that there have different backgrounds. So I think that really helps, you know, like with Matthew Stevens, some of his music may feel like it is influenced by indie rock, and with Aaron Parks, contemporary classical music. Our vocalist, Debo, she's from Haiti and she sings in different languages and she was classically trained. Morgan Guerin is a multi-instrumentalist, you know, that's very much into the new school, you know, jazz, of blending things anyway, you know. And then adding the spoken word or hip hop element with rap too. So it was just a natural thing and a combination of people. It was more about the combination of people that brought the kind of just natural melting together of genres and styles. Mm-hmm.
You've played with a lot of amazing musicians over the years, Herbie Hancock, and I've been watching a lot of videos of your live shows with different people. I think you spent a good amount of time with Jack DeJohnette too.
He's like one of my biggest mentors.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Tell me about your time with him and what stands out spending time with him.
He really helped, him and his wife, Olivia, really helped open me up. And a matter of fact, the first visit I went up there, I was 18. And that's the, you know, we talk and, you know, talk about music. And the first thing he said was, we have to open you up. Because I was really a jazz head. And, you know, he started introducing me to all kinds of other music. I remember he played me Yellow Jacket's album that had just come out. And we went to a string quartet concert, a reggae concert, a solo guitar concert. He turned me on to Jim Pepper and the Wild Chop Tools and, you know, just all kinds of things. So, yeah, they were very instrumental in me exposing me to other styles. And eventually, you know, I fell in love with all these other things. Yeah, so that was super important. But also, just opening, staying open as a musician and drummer, composer. I mean, he was, you know, band leading as a drummer, composer, and, you know, that's kind of what, you know, wanted to do. So he was, you know, kind of my biggest influence in that way, because I had the good fortune to spend so much time with him.
I play piano and drums, and I'm sure I started playing drums before piano, you know, just tapping on stuff. And, you know, of course, drums, they're hard to practice around other people. Just they're louder and less melodic. Mm-hmm. And people are like, would you just play a different instrument? But I just kept playing, and I love playing drums and piano too. A lot of people look at the drummer as not the most important person in a band. You know, there's a stereotype about, you know, they're just keeping the beat or something. I've never had that feeling, and just the physicality of it, the rhythm of it. And I happened upon an interview you did for Jazz Times last year, and you said drummers are natural leaders. A band only sounds as good as its drummer.
Yeah, I believe that. Because, yeah, it's, I don't know, it's a phenomenon, but it's just an instrument that takes up that much space, that, you know, it's able to kind of direct the feeling of a piece, you know, direct the direction and the colors, you know, like it you play a certain way and it makes other people come that way, you know, with you. It's just a very powerful instrument. Anybody that's great on any instrument can do that. Everybody really can lead. But generally you're not in situations where you have, you know, that equal levels of artistry on the stage. I mean, sometimes, but often you're not. But even in those situations when the drummer is great, you know, the band still sounds really good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to say anything about the current tour you're doing and the lineup, you know, who you're performing with. And I don't know, it's still a weird time around the world too, with traveling and wearing masks and being vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And it seems largely venues are opening, but you maybe have to show you're vaccinated and wear a mask. Mm-hmm. And all that. And traveling is still a little extra mm-hmm. intense. I don't know how that's all affecting you and what you're thinking about that.
You know, at this point, I'm just rolling with the flow. And if I think about it too long, I'd rather stay in the house. You know, I'd rather not take any chances. But we live in a world where you have to take chances. I mean, we take them musically too. You know, we you know, great artists are risk takers. So, you know, I actually fight the part of me that wants to just stay in and not, you know, avoid all risk. And then, you know, there's a part of you that just has to keep doing what you do. You know, you have to keep working, whether that work is outside the house or in the house. But, you know, the way we have been working over all these years, you know, it shifted. So, I mean, I'm trying to, you know, find a balance and keep some of that shift happening still. So I'm not going out quite as much, but also trying to just be as careful as I can and go out when I can and when it makes sense. And yeah, make sure that other people are being conscious and aware too. And, you know, we're all in this together for the most part. So it behooves everybody to be cautious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's become especially clear, you know, the last year and a half, how people need live performance, and musicians and other performers are like the people carrying this torch of telling stories and inspiring people and helping people move their bodies. And people have missed that a lot.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things, right, where you don't know how important it is until it's not there. So that's actually one, I guess, caveat that people appreciate us more now.
Hey, just a couple other things about the waiting game. I just love that you're, you know, again, mentioning the Black Panthers, because as people are talking about defund the police, it's ended up meaning pretty different things to different people. Are you kidding? You mean actually getting rid of the police? And and the Black Panthers are one model that we can really point to and say, that's kind of what we mean instead of the police. People providing safety for the community, food, childcare, and, you know, a system for safety that doesn't involve people shooting at us. I really appreciate you mentioning them. And there's some really interesting songs on here too. Purple Mountains, which really focuses on the tragedy of how Indigenous people have been treated here. And Pray the Gay Away, which I wonder if you'd say something about. This has samples in it that are really disturbing, which is really effective. And unfortunately, there's no shortage of coming up with audio samples like that. But tell me about that song.
Well, some of those aren't samples. Some of them are, you know, we recreated some things because I didn't want to get in sample trouble. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing, you know, with using samples from, or, you know, actual statements that people said. Because it really doesn't matter, you know, like who said it, you know, or I could have made it all up and it still would have been accurate. I mean, you know what I mean? But some people are going to feel that way. And I mean, it really happened because I heard, you know, some of this online, and I just felt like it made me write that piece immediately. And I didn't want to really make it a vocal piece and have a whole lot of words. And so I just tried to use the statements effectively and then have just, you know, the chorus hook. And then somebody told me, a few people actually told me, and because, you know, you're working on an album for a long time, you know what you mean, but everybody else may not. So the hook being Pray the Gay Away, some people were concerned that people would think that that's what I meant, you know, that they wouldn't see the irony or satire in it. And in fact, I had hired, you know, this guy to come out and do some gigs on the road. And when he heard that song, he said he just wouldn't be able to travel. With, you know, he's like, I have, you know, people in my family are gay, and I have some of my friends, and if this is what you're about, I can't. I was like, oh, wow, I guess I really do need to put something in there. So in the, when it gets to the bridge, which is a trumpet solo, I had Casa Overall say, we need to pray the hate away to make sure that people understood that I was not actually suggesting to pray the gay away. But yeah, I mean, so often it seems that, that, you know, the religious, the foundation of religions on various fronts, it seems like that's what, if you keep talking to somebody long enough, it seems like it will go back to your religious foundation often, you know what I mean? And so I think it's, you know, a simple statement, but it really covers a lot of bases with why homophobia exists. And yeah, so much of it is traced back to that. So that's, you know, really the premise of the song.
It's really interesting how presenting in art or music something that's ironic, it can get understood as being the total opposite. And you mentioned religion, and of course it's bizarre and mind-blowing that all these religions, their core thing is be kind to other people, especially people you disagree with. And then this becomes the foundation of hurting other people and manipulating people and even killing people. It's insane.
Yeah. It's totally the same, right? I mean, that's from the beginning, you know? Like, religion has always had that conflict. So, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. I feel really honored to hang out with you and talk with you, and I love your music, and thanks for making time to speak with me. I don't know if you have anything else you really want to mention or not.
No, you know, I just would like for people to come out to the gig and check it out. It's different experience live than on the record, which I think hopefully is a good thing. You know, I hope that our music and our message is, you know, that we're able to spread it as widely as possible. And it's, you know, we're part of a community, and this is collective work. And so we're trying to do our share, and hoping that, you know, that the message is embraced by the community there.
Mm-hmm. I think it will be. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for the good questions too. You ask good questions. So many interviews I do, people, you know, they just either they don't do enough research, or they're just, you know, it's not a subject matter, you know, that they're really well formed in. So, thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, for me, it's a way of learning and diving in and falling in love with music and all these, honestly, the political issues you're talking about, I've been focused on for 30 years, and it's mm-hmm. great to have great music and great ideas together. Nothing better.
Thank you.
All right.
Take care.
Okay. Enjoy the evening.
Okay, you too.
Bye now. You've been listening to an interview with jazz drummer, band leader, and educator Terry Lynn Carrington. My name is John Malkin, and this program is called Transformation Highway. This is KZSC 88.1 FM, KZSC.org.
Hi, this is Terry Lynn Carrington, and you're listening to KZSC 88.1 FM. Thank you.
bells ring loudly, bullets blurring, deferring dreams like it ain't no thing, proudly. Another brother slain in vain in the name of justice. Though really, it feels more like just them. It seems we've only been a friend to the system that one time our juice contained a little shot of Johnny. Beyond the stars and stripes and prison bars and stereotypes, blue lives splatter red on canvases of brown skin, as if black lives mattering is a game to them and not a basic right within. All men are created equal. Say her name, hashtags validate what shiny badges boldly violate. Sirens swell, morphing into church bells, signaling another unjustifiable death, and yet another mother left childless.
You took my love.
Morphing into church bells, signaling another unjustifiable